Joe Conniff was committing crimes in downtown Seattle to support his drug habit. Now he's a certified peer counselor and author of the new memoir called Causes and Conditions, A Life Experience in Addiction and Recovery. Joe will share his experience with you in just a few minutes here on KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. I'm glad to have you along today. Our first story this hour, salmon. Salmon numbers are in serious decline, as you probably know. To help them swim, complete their journey, dozens of hydroelectric dams have been removed in Washington over the last 10 years. Now, a Republican Idaho Congressman, Mike Simpson, wants to remove four dams from the Lower Snake River near the Washington-Idaho border. Lots of environmentalists are into that, but Washington Governor Jay Inslee and both of our U.S. senators oppose the plan. Caught in the middle is the Nez Perce tribe, which has fought for dam removal for decades. I asked Nez Perce Vice Chairman Shannon Wheeler why the tribe supports Representative Simpson's proposal.
For starters, we commend Congressman Simpson on his proposal and support Congressman Simpson's proposal as it looks at a comprehensive look of the whole Columbia Basin, also from the energy sectors. And this proposal is more energy centric than it is anything else. But we're just glad that he is taking a good solid look at salmon recovery and what that means to the Nez Perce tribe.
When you say energy centric, typically there's this conflict between creating energy, generating hydropower, and a healthy salmon run.
Yeah, you know, with the dams and the needs for power, because we all know that we all have needs for power and we love to turn our lights on and charge our phones and we love warm showers and all these other things that come with electricity, is something that we need to say, yes, we agree with that. But also, as we look at the plan, we also need to say that, you know, the energy and that's being produced from the dams also have a side effect by those dams. Also, the prospects of looking at renewable energies going into the future, whether it's wind, solar, nuclear, that those are options that are now out there that weren't viable maybe 20 years ago. Or 30 years ago, or, you know, even 10 years ago.
So you see an opportunity now to finally remove these dams. But as you know, Washington's Governor Jay Inslee and our two U.S. senators came out against this Idaho congressman's proposal to breach the dams. Have our governor and our senators told you why that is?
Well, you know, we've had an opportunity to speak with Governor Inslee and state our position and what we feel is strong about Congressman Simpson's proposal. And, you know, many of the things that Governor Inslee sent out after his Columbia Basin work group that he put together, the salmon work group, that had a lot of kind of diverse interest in that, including the Nez Perce tribe. We had our Department of Fisheries manager, Dave Johnson, on that. He put together some really good comments for the Columbia River systems of operation, that the environmental impact statement that the federal action agencies were doing, NOAA and Bonneville Power, U.S. Army Corps, and Bureau of Reclamations, had completed under the administration of the former administration on a fast track. And so then they created a biological opinion from those environmental impact statements and then had a record of decision that was really kind of unfavorable to the tribes and the impacts to tribes, the social economic impacts and long-term impacts that the tribes have sustained through the course of time. That Governor Inslee's comments and letters to the Federal Action Agency spoke to that and spoke to breaching. So we were just hoping that Governor Inslee would, you know, that work and statements that he put out, he would seem like maybe he could support Congressman Simpson's proposal. And we still don't feel like Governor Inslee has completely rejected Congressman Simpson's proposal. So I think there's probably just some things that Governor Inslee would like to see that, you know, in this proposal, as it is a proposal and it's not legislation until they start writing and pass it through Congress. But I think that's what Governor Inslee was kind of concerned with. And, you know, it's understandable that he has a lot of interest in the state of Washington. other than salmon interests to consider. But we would hope that, you know, through the experience, science, and technology that we're kind of speaking about now, that he will lean more towards support of Congressman Simpson's proposal.
In the statements that I've seen from Governor Inslee and our two U.S. senators, they say they want a more comprehensive solution than what this Idaho Congress member's putting on the table, that the Washington officials want to see more research into how to replace that hydropower, how to use the river for irrigation and transportation, more investments in clean energy, habitat restoration, the agricultural economy. What do you make of their concerns?
Well, you know, that is a lot of interest that are coming forward and speaking to them and wanting to have the conversations that are candid, which of course we definitely support. We support candid conversations, and we'd like to have those candid conversations with the senators of the Northwest delegation to speak about Congressman Simpson's proposal. But I just think the actual legislation, where the considerations coming from the senators and their concerns are understandable. But at the same time, you know, salmon don't have time to sit and talk about them any longer. You know, I mean, we can walk through grout and do a slow process here and a heavy process, but we also have to know that what salmon are experiencing in the face of climate warming is definitely an issue where we need to move a little bit faster, and the science has already been done, and we just need to make sure that, you know, we put money aside to take these actions.
Shannon Wheeler is vice chair of the Nez Perce tribe. The affiliated tribes of Northwest Indians have called on President Biden to help get funding for dam removal and salmon restoration. What are you asking him to do? What do you think President Biden will do?
Well, for one, we hope that the administration takes notice of the problem. Two, we hope that the administration speaks with us. And three, we hope that the administration formulates a plan off the information that they receive and take action on that information that they receive.
Is there any way to both preserve those dams and help the fish runs?
Well, right now, you know, the science says that, you know, the slack water that's being created and predation that's in those pools and the climate warming that's affecting those, the salmon, you know, are genetically built to move in fast-paced water and move fast. Generally, the juvenile migration took 2 days to get to the ocean. And now you're talking weeks and going through turbines and over dams. And for me, it'd be like asking an athlete to train for a large event and then come up with a twisted ankle and then ask them to go perform on an ability where you're maybe 60%. And for the juvenile smolts, it's life or death. You know, the timing that they have to go down there and the, you know, as much as they're harmed going through these turbines and spillways and the predation that they face. And, you know, there's just many things before they even get to the ocean. And then with climate warming, the ocean conditions, you know, that's an issue too, as well. So, I mean, not only the barriers that are getting to the ocean, but now the ocean is really even a stronger call to breach the dams and to allow this species to not become extinct and to really help them get there, do our part.
Mr. Wheeler, what does the loss of salmon mean for the Nez Perce?
Well, you know, for starters, you know, we have an ancient covenant with the salmon and them giving themselves to us for nutrition and not only us, but the longer relationship that they have with the landscape, bringing marine nutrients to the landscape, whether it's the trees or, you know, the berry plants or roots or the fauna that's out there. You know, we have the ungulates that are, you know, deer and elk and moose, you know, all those things that depend on a balanced environment out there that is full of these nutrients that are returned in the bodies of salmon and decaying salmon. That's something that needs to be considered and looked at too, is that longer relationship with the landscape that we're just a part of. So as we consider ourselves part of the land and not separate from that, if that is being affected, it's also affecting us. And, you know, of course, that was reserved in our Treaty of 1855 with the United States at arm's length, ratified in 1859 and enshrined in the United States Constitution under Article 6, Clause 2, that the treaties are the supreme law of the land. And so that was the way of life that was preserved for us. And that's the covenant that we have and the relationship that we understand that the salmon have to the land, and we're a part of the landscape. So that's what it means to not have salmon, is that we coexist with them. So, you know, we can't afford to lose a part of who we are.
We're talking with the vice chair for the Nez Perce tribe, Shannon Wheeler. Mr. Wheeler, if these dams were breached or removed even, how confident are you that the salmon can rebound?
Well, I think the salmon are very resilient, a very resilient species, and have survived up to this point. We put a better toolbox, I guess, if you would say. We add more tools to their toolbox that they need and as they migrate down. And it's just like I'd mentioned before, if you're an athlete training, you know, you want to be in the best possible condition when you get to the place where you're going to be challenged the most. And that's, of course, in the ocean. So we have to do our part. And so, you know, we've turned all the dials that we can here in the headwaters and restoration work. And, you know, you can't do any more in the wilderness area because it's already pristine habitat. So the restoration work that we're doing between here and the wilderness area, we've done much of what we could do. You know, we tried to come up with solutions for the problems that they were having. And we just need to turn some bigger dials, and breaching is a bigger dial that needs to be turned, that, you know, in the declining numbers, you know, as we look at a report that the tribe put out about a month ago on a quasi-extinction threshold, that, you know, they're operate right now, 44% of the tributaries and Nez Perce waters that we have our rights in are experiencing that quasi-extinction threshold, which means that 50 fewer natural spawners have returned for 4 consecutive years to those waters. And the trajectory for that right now is that 77% over the next 4 years will reach that threshold. And so, you know, if that's not a call to alarm, I don't know what is. And we know that, you know, we've turned the dials, all the dials that we can up to this point. And those bigger dials like breaching need to be turned. Even if you listen to Congressman Simpson, you know, 20 years ago, he lashing that, yeah, not until we tried everything else. Well, we've tried everything else. And it points to breaching. If it's ocean conditions, well, the fish were declining before ocean conditions were an issue. And since the 1970s, those numbers have been dropping since. I mean, for the numbers that used to come back in the millions, if we're lucky in one of our tributaries, we were able to harvest 11 fish last year. And we closed our fisheries down in the Snake River this year for no fishing. Very dire right now, and the need is urgent, and it's now. A call for action is now. The fish don't have the luxury to change.
That was Nez Perce Vice Chairman Shannon Wheeler talking about a contentious proposal out of Idaho to remove dams from the lower Snake River. You're listening to The Record on KUOW. We're going to get back outdoors a little bit later in the show and take your phone calls as we discuss where and how to get out and recreate on a crazy hot weekend and just in summertime in general. I hope you can stay tuned for more of The Record. We're going to be right back. We'll be right back. How should Seattle and King County help people who are addicted to drugs? Do people need detox, 12-step, monitoring, counseling, jail? My next guest has been through all of that. Joe Conniff was addicted to drugs, living on the streets, committed crimes to support his addiction. Today, Joe is a certified peer counselor in Seattle and the author of a memoir called Causes and Conditions, A Life Experience in Addiction and Recovery. I talked to Joe about a moment that helped lead him to recovery, a drug bust in Seattle's open-air drug market known as The Blade.
So, yeah, I was picked up out on The Blade back in 2015 for charges associated with fueling my substance use disorder. At the time, I was addicted to heroin, crack cocaine, and was arrested for charges for selling to support my habit and selling the narcotics. And so, you know, The Blade exists as this, you know, geographical location in downtown Seattle, in the core of the downtown area by the Pike Place Market, most notably 3rd Avenue between Pike and Pine, and known historically, you know, to my context, as the largest open-air drug market in the Pacific Northwest of Washington State. And so, you know, I could think that, you know, many people local to the area, familiar with the area, would know that's, you know, kind of a hotbed for crime, for drug use and theft and things of that nature. And, you know, I've definitely experienced that firsthand. And it's also kind of a an area of survival for me. It was kind of the last house on the block, the last accessible known place and stop for me before a period of incarceration and the arresting of my, not just me, but of my addiction at the time too. And I've been in recovery since.
What was that survival on the street like for you, Joe?
Oh, you know, kind of give you a quick scope of a day is, you know, sleeping in Post Alley down behind Pike Place Market under what was State Route 99 at the time, at the Spring Street exit off the viaduct, and, you know, starting my day off hoping to, you know, come out of withdrawal from, you know, heroin withdrawal, trying to find some dope for the day. And in many cases that meant, you know, stealing from local downtown stores, helping somebody else find drugs and, you know, hoping to, you know, have somebody be generous with that. A lot of it was very much, you know, there was difficulties associated with it, you know, just being out in the elements. I spent the majority of my time out there during that those winter months of 2015. And I also experienced, you know, which may come as a surprise, is a felt sense of community that gave me something that I no longer had access to in other areas of my life, you know, ideally because I had alienated myself due to my use and the criminal behavior and nature behind supporting it. But out there, at least I found other people that lived life and understood the desire to find relief from a painful existence in the way I did. And even though that was short-lived with substances, it worked very quickly on the front end. And so it gave me a sense of identity to be out there with other people surviving like that. And just kind of, it was very much living for the moment, not living in the moment.
So in your case, Joe, your addictions were also linked to homelessness and crime. And these are things we talk about on this show all the time. Based on your experience, what do you think Seattle and King County can do about these problems and do better than we're doing?
That's a great question. You know, we're faced with such a massive number of individuals experiencing homelessness, substance use disorder, mental health crisis. I feel like, you know, we really have an intersection of a lot of things that lead to that. You know, at least in my personal experiences, I found drugs and alcohol did for me what I didn't know how to do for myself. It provided some type of relief from difficulties in my life. And so I look at things like socioeconomic factors, childhood trauma, you know, painful lived experiences, abusive relationships, economic hardship, all these things that, you know, seemingly it's like, why would somebody turn to drugs? Why would somebody turn to crime? We know that's not a viable solution long term to these things, but in the short term, it very much works. These are individuals' best attempts at solving problems. And so I think what is a community in a region we really need to be focused on is getting down to being able to serve individuals, not trying to say, okay, we're going to get all this money for housing and we're going to get everybody indoors. That's one I hear about a lot. And then, you know, for many individuals, I think getting folks indoors is very much a great start. It's very much a lot of it, but it's not everything. Providing emotional support, helping people establish economic stability, social stability, alleviating chronic illnesses and other things like that. And to get to that layer of things, we really have to get to know people, not just a population.
I want to talk to you more about what's going on with us individually, the stories, what you've learned about the stories we tell ourselves. Before we leave these outside solutions, one of the topics that comes up a lot is policing, the war on drugs, abolishing jails. Would you have stopped using if it weren't for policing and jail?
You know, the straight answer to that is no, I don't believe so. You know, and then I think to follow that up is to really understand my own white privilege. You know, the means of being a straight cis white male operating in a system that was not designed to keep me behind bars. You know, looking at just a few days ago, marked 50 years since the acknowledgement and the declaration of the war on drugs, and looking at who has been most harshly impacted by that, you know, Black, Indigenous, people of color, community members. And so when I look at, you know, would I have stopped? No, you know, but it's also looking at, because it works for me and it did at that time, I also don't want to get anybody sold on the idea that we need to, you know, this is great. Let's do this thing that this guy got connected to. And so, you know, for me is it's like, oh, great. This worked really well. And I felt supported and I felt encouraged. And I think the system and individuals representing aspects of the system, law enforcement and incarceration institutions and things of that nature, it can't serve every community member effectively, you know, when it's meant to take me in and, you know, for lack of a better term, spit me back out felony free.
Well, let's talk about the individual now. You're a certified peer counselor. Again, I'm speaking with Joe Conniff, and the memoir, the new book, is called Causes and Conditions, A Life Experience in Addiction and Recovery. So as a drug counselor now, Joe, what advice do you give to people who are addicted as you were?
I think what it really comes down to me, and I talk about my experience on the Blade, is that I got a sense of community out there. And I think understanding and looking at it through that lens of my own experience when I work with somebody else is, you know, what does your community look like right now? You know, for somebody who's in active use, somebody who's in crisis, you know, maybe they're using is in response to a difficult abusive situation at home and those things. Do you have community? Or somebody who's living in the streets, is your community, is these other people who are, you know, living and using out of doors, surviving? Is it's very difficult to, I think, to anticipate somebody to transition over to some community that they have no idea of the expectation, no idea if we're going to be welcome. And it's very much, I think, a sense of trying to learn to embrace discomfort. And, you know, I hear things like, growth doesn't come from comfort zones, you know, things like that. And that's what I heard in early recovery. And it's very much my addiction was about responding to uncomfortable circumstances in my life by trying to make them comfortable. And drugs did that. And so that's what I like to do, is get in that space and stand with people in that discomfort and just be there with them, not trying to change anything, you know, just, hey, let's look at this together. Stop feeling like I'm terminally unique in my life circumstances. I'm beyond human aid, you know, of any sort. And hey, I'm going to be in that place with you without you having to change anything. You know, and that's, I think that's where at large we have a difficult place, is we see people struggling in our community. It's like, I want them to be better. And it's like, we know what better is for individuals.
Well, Joe, trying to escape that discomfort, trying to stop that suffering, that is completely understandable. What is a personal story that you tell someone you're working with as a peer counselor to help the light go on, that there's another way to deal with their problem?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, the last couple of years that I was in my addiction, as I got very familiar with going through the county correctional system for a week or 2 weeks at a time, and very much was this experience of, you know, this was a massive hindrance on my lifestyle. Like, this is, you know, this is creating a barrier between me and my drugs and my substances that are giving me some relief. And finally, there was a point in which the arrest on the blade happened, which was probably my fourth or fifth one that year. But that was the one that brought me into a drug diversion court in King County. Was this experience that I was separated from substances for now a reasonable period of time, almost about a month, which was longer than my previous little incarceration stints. And I started finding that, I was introduced to a treatment counselor while I was in custody treatment programming. I was introduced to a veterans case manager, having been a Navy vet, I started to offer some support and started to realize that my perception of this entire experience of incarceration and interrupting my drug using lifestyle, was this big setback, as it was my perspective of my experience with incarceration finally shifted to, wait, like I have this opportunity here to embrace some change and look at this as an opportunity while behind bars to work on myself. I had my daughter coming to visit me over the course of the summer of 2015. And I couldn't think for the life of me for a period of time, how do I change this? And I think that was probably had the most profound impact on, how I perceive my situation. I went on from there after that turn of events to spend another 3 months incarcerated and started embracing mindfulness practices and yoga and started building a relationship with myself, which was something that I hadn't had for 15 years.
Yeah, this mindfulness is a big theme in your book of not trying to run away from or dull the pain, being there for it.
Yeah, there's, definitely mindfulness is, it's a buzzword. It has been for some time.
Yeah.
It gets thrown around a little loosely, be mindful or I'm practicing mindfulness. And I think, the way that I experience it and the best way I can describe it to somebody else is it's about really just paying attention on purpose, like being here with whatever our experience is, however it's unfolding, pleasant, unpleasant, trying to be with that non-judgmentally. Trying to just understand, okay, this is kind of an unsatisfactory experience and I don't have to change it. So for an addict, that's a pretty radical practice. Also, when things are going well, realizing, okay, like this isn't going to last forever either. And for me, as somebody who spent 15 years in active addiction, chasing, one hit of relief, one pleasant circumstance after another, and only creating more unpleasant ones in the process, this feeling like a hamster on a wheel, to be here, to be present with the moment and watch it unfold. To me, that was what recovery had to be all about. Like if addiction was this flight from reality, then man, recovery's got to be about this mindfulness business. It's got to be about arriving here in my body with whatever's unfolding and not trying to escape from the moment.
You've heard politicians, lots of people say that what folks need is to take personal responsibility. What does that mean to you?
I think when we hear politicians talking about personal responsibilities, it pertains to, I think, things like addiction, the addiction crisis is, I think that's a narrative that's very much rooted in, jargon from the war on drugs, right? Is going to, hold people accountable. And in that, it kind of alludes to the idea that addiction is a choice. And I think personal responsibility is a part of recovery, for the individual. Recovery for me had its most profound impact when I did take responsibility for how I impacted my community, how I impacted relationships with my loved ones, my family members, and, people that I had caused harm to. And I feel like we hear politicians talking about taking responsibility as it's rooted in punishment. Rooted in the sense they're going to punish this out of people, and just the right amount of it, the right amount of pressure. And it's interesting is it's like, the idea that we would continue to try to punish people for something that is clearly defined by its resistance to punishment. That's addiction right there. And it's like, that's, 50 years of in that framework practice of, operating from this war on drugs. Is it going to be tough on crime? Are going to be tough on drugs? And what that becomes is not a war on drugs. It becomes a war on people. And so I think there's a piece of this where when it comes to crimes fueled by substance use that have an impact on community members and like residential burglary, vehicle theft, vehicle prowl, ID theft, forgery, things that are, you know, there is a scope of holding people accountable, helping them be responsible. But again, with that is still being compassionate enough to understand that, yes, it's compassionate to help hold people responsible and remedy some of the behaviors and the harm caused to others. And also still, you know, want to get them past the substance use disorder. You know, I didn't like doing the things I did. I didn't like stealing from stores. I didn't like prowling vehicles, you know, those kind of things. And I think it's really realizing too, is that separates the type of crimes that our community and our policies are willing to charge too, is do we hold people accountable for selling substances to support their habit? When is it really a larger impact on the community to the extent that residential burglary and vehicle prowls and things of that nature are having on other people? And it's really separating as, okay, like, we just don't like seeing people engage in this behavior versus, okay, people are engaged in this behavior and it's having an impact, you know, on my family's safety and security. And I think it's just really being able to separate where some have just been policies meant to stigmatize and further marginalize individuals that are already experiencing crisis and difficulty.
Final question, Joe. People are listening to you now of all kinds of situations and backgrounds. Is there something you can leave us with, either a reason for hope or something that we can do?
Yeah, this is probably going to sound kind of cliche, but, you know, one of the things that comes to mind is, you know, if I can do it, you can, based on, you know, the things that I experienced. I had been, you know, lost a career in the military to my drug use. I had, you know, lost the ability to show up as a parent and those things. And I feel like that's kind of a cookie cutter thing that people hear around recovery, but I don't want to have anybody underestimate the power of, even in the face of extreme adversity, continuing to show up the best we can with compassion and kindness and positive, you know, unconditional positive regard for people, regardless of how we see them showing up in our community. Is that, you know, if somebody's out there, there's hope for change. And it may not be the change that I'm attached to seeing happen, but positive improvement can happen.
Positive
really
improvement,
I believe,
happen.
That has to start by understanding the interconnectedness of all of us as individuals. That, you know, I think large-scale addiction, large-scale dislocation that has happened, especially here in our city in Seattle, is a result of policies and practices that have made it difficult to survive, made it difficult to you know, ease into a quality of living that people don't need to find relief from a discomforting, you know, condition in the human experience. And so never underestimating the power of, you know, just expressing generosity and kindness and compassion to everybody in our community, even when it's difficult. That's the time when it's needed most.
Joe Conniff, former drug addict and current peer counselor in Seattle, his new memoir is called Causes and Conditions, A Life Experience in Addiction and Recovery. To the record on KUOW, in just a moment, we're going to talk hiking, camping in the super heat this weekend, but generally the rest of the summer. We're taking your phone calls, so give us a call. We're going to open the phone lines right now. The number is 206-543-KUOW for your questions. We're going to talk with a get out there and hike and camp expert. You can ask questions. You can share your own advice and stories and wisdom. The phone number again, 206-543-5869, and we'll be right back. Oh, we're headed into a sizzling weekend here, and I could understand you wanting to stay inside. Might be wise, but there are only so many Seattle summer weekends, and I don't know. It hurts me to spend one of them indoors. How can we enjoy the outdoors this weekend and once things have hopefully returned to whatever a normal summer is anymore? Let's ask all of that to Kendra Ramos, who runs communication and outreach at Washington Trails Association. Kendra, welcome back to KUOW.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Good to talk with you again. And we want you, listener, to join in this conversation. We're opening the phone lines now. Maybe you are looking for a hiking, camping, backpacking suggestion. Or I would love it if you called and shared a suggestion with the rest of us, maybe a good story. Here's our phone number, area code 206-543-KUOW. What kind of adventures are you after this summer? The number is 206-543-5869. Kendra, first of all, what should we know about hiking in extreme summer heat?
Well, I think that anytime you're thinking about hiking, but particularly in extreme weather, it's more important than ever that you do your research, both know the weather conditions, but also the conditions of where you're headed out to, make sure you have the right gear. And the most important piece of gear any hiker carries with them is, of course, their good judgment. Don't let your desire to kind of appreciate the summer push you further than you need to go. It's really important to remember that heat stroke can come on really fast, and so you want to stay hydrated, you want to have sun protection, and those conditions can also change with the sunny days. It's still snowy in the mountains, so you want to make sure you kind of know what you're getting into there. Just because it's hot here, it still feels like you're in the winter sometimes when you're at Mount Rainier. It's still pretty much under snow, so...
Yeah, this is the corollary to telling people that you can get in the water, but be aware that that water is melted snow.
Exactly. I think, you know, it's hot out, but that water is going to be pretty darn cold if you end up in it. And there's definitely cold water shock to think about. And so just similarly, if you're going to hit the snow, you want to make sure you have the right gear for that conditions, and you're thoughtful about what that means. Kind of, is it kind of solid snow? Is it starting to melt? Really being kind of thoughtful about that? Or is it a day where, you know, some of my favorite hikes are big trees and flowing water? Maybe it's time to kind of experience some river walks and appreciate that shade, and those conditions cooler.
I once backpacked in the North Cascades in August with my young daughter and in a group, and we had to sleep on snow, which we were not in any, I was not in any way expecting that. And, you know, it turned out to be a great story, you know, and a good memory, but because we were prepared. But I'm just signing on to what you're saying, Kendra. Are you going out this weekend? Or are you staying indoors?
I am going out this weekend. I have a road trip planned already, so I'm doing some extra research because it's going to be a lot hotter than I thought it was going to be, and making sure I pack a lot more water and electrolytes. But I'm headed out this weekend. So,
again, our phone number for questions or suggestions of your own is area code 206-543-KUOW, 543-5869. How should we choose a destination?
I think it's really about figuring out what it is you're looking for when you go outside. One of the great things about WTA's website is that you can really pick a hike that suits your particular needs. Are you wanting to do about 3 miles and keep it flat and then maybe hit a lake? You can put those conditions in, and kind of it will provide hike suggestions. Are you really looking for that summit view? Are you hoping to kind of get a little bit more exercise in? I think it's really about figuring out what that experience is that you're looking for. Then start to find hikes that match those conditions. Do a little bit of research. See what kind of the folks who've written trip reports and done it before you have said. As we're just starting to see things open up in the kind of high country, you know, it's been a rough winter of snow and rain, so kind of checking out, are there trees down, is the trail actually accessible, and then go with an open mind and be prepared to kind of judge the situation when you get there, and know the trail will always be there another day, but you know, it's the memories that you make along the way that are most important.
It's gotten so crowded here. The number of hikers has more than doubled in the last decade or so. Can we, if you don't have a reservation, can you expect to have someplace to lay your head on a summer weekend, or is that unrealistic?
You know, it's going to be tough. I think the last several years have really highlighted how important getting outdoors are. I know that the, you know, last year and a half being outside has really been so important to my mental and physical well-being and to so many others. And that's really a powerful thing. But our infrastructure is still catching up on how we can support all the folks looking for that experience. So it can be tough. There are definitely people who planned ahead and aren't able to go places now. So there are some last minute cancellations, but there aren't as many as some of us would hope for sure.
Yeah, I'm talking with Kendra Ramos from WTA, Washington Trails Association. I'm getting ideas from her, and we're taking your calls, 206-543-KUOW. Mohammed is our first call in Burien. Mohammed, thanks for calling. What's your idea or your question?
Hi. So I'm actually one of the lung doctors down here, and I found that my wife and I, when we go hiking, we tend to do a bit stuff that's a bit more strenuous than most of my patients can handle. And I was hoping to get some ideas for patients that may have difficulty walking or might not be able to be outside for too long. So maybe something of an easier hike that they can enjoy on a weekend like this.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that city and county parks are an amazing place to start. Washington has so many close-in green spaces that we're really blessed with. And I think looking at places like Evans Creek Preserve, where there's a beautiful meadow and then also some kind of woodland options, you can do similar things at kind of city parks all over the place. And just remembering that, you know, a hike doesn't have to be climbing a mountain. Spending half a mile in a place that's green and beautiful has a lot of those same benefits. And I encourage everybody to start with what works for them and kind of find those experiences.
Mohammed, are you telling your patients anything about hiking and heat and climate change and wildfire smoke? You're a lung doctor.
Yeah, so one of the main things I always try to remind people is that even if you're not working up a sweat, you lose a lot of moisture if you're breathing heavy to begin with. So especially on a hot day, if you find yourself doing any kind of exertion, just be very cognizant of that. You don't necessarily have to be sweating to lose water. So just, you know, stay hydrated. And then as wildfire season starts to come up, we saw this a lot last year. If you're able to have a purifier, that'll make your life a lot better in general. But just be cognizant of kind of like the air quality. I think airnow.gov is a really good resource. And so later on this summer, that might be very helpful. But, you know, just keep in mind, you're probably losing a lot more moisture than you realize just by breathing.
Thanks, Mohammed, and enjoy Evans Creek Preserve or whatever it is that you end up doing. Thanks for calling and talking with Kendra Ramos, who's at Washington Trails Association. So we mentioned wildfires there. Some places have been in Washington State and beyond have been devastated, you know, taken apart by wildfire. Mm-hmm. Do anything we should know about how to deal with that, navigate that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that unfortunately wildfires are becoming more and more common here in Washington. And obviously the best piece of advice is kind of do everything you can to prevent those fires. We're already seeing the Department of Natural Resources on the east side of the state has a burn ban going into effect. And so really being thoughtful about, are campfires permitted or necessary? How can you really minimize that? Making sure that you aren't unintentionally causing harm, whether it's kind of starting a car in parked dried grass or making sure you leave your fire completely out if you do have one is really important. And then, of course, the effects of the fire last long after the fire is out. It can cause soil to become unstable and trees to fall. And so you still will see several trails that are closed years after fire as they continue to kind of feel the impacts of that. And, you know, it takes a long time to repair some of that damage through trail maintenance and other aspects. So
Yeah, and please skip the fireworks. Speaking of which, that's definitely our next call for Kendra Ramos. Louisa is calling from Linwood. Louisa, what's up?
Hi, I need to get myself and my dog out of town for 4th of July. Linwood has a tradition of setting up lots of fireworks on the 4th, even though they're banned. And I am just going to throw my dog in the car and drive, and was hoping for some suggestions of a place that's remote enough to just go and be with my dog until it's going to come back to the town. I was thinking of driving up Snoqualmie Passway, maybe a little bit of a nighttime hike on a dog-friendly trail would be nice, or just somewhere I can pull off on the side of the road and just wait things out.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's definitely places where on Forest Service land you can disperse camps for the evening if you are not able to find a place. Also, you know, there's services like Hip Camp, which might have more reservations than if you're not able to find one through sort of the rec.gov. And thinking about pups too, as we talk about the heat, it is just as important to make sure that your four-legged friends stay hydrated and kind of consider their paws. Rocks are going to be hotter than normal, so I think it's great to kind of think about our furry hiking companions as we're figuring out solutions too.
Yeah, good call and good reminder about 4th of July. And I hope, Louisa, I hope you can get out far from the screaming memes here
too,
over the next several days. Thanks for your call. And Hip Camp is just HIPCAMP.com. It says, I'm looking at it now. Find yourself outside, discover and book tent camping, RV parks, cabins, tree houses, and glamping.
Go ahead. Oh, sorry. It's sort of like an Airbnb or for more of a camping lens. So if you're not able to find a traditional campsite, it's another option to kind of just give you more places to look.
Great. And I think Brian is on the phone with a suggestion from Skyway. Brian, what's a hiking, camping, recreating idea this summer?
Hey, Bill. So I ride motorcycles in the mountains and camp off my bike a lot. And when you're on a bike, got a lot of heat coming up from the engine, protective gear on, gets really hot. So my favorite is an ice-filled Camelback at all times, mm-hmm. 3 liter at least. And I did a 6-month ride cross country, and I learned that for free, you could go into most any mini mart, and if you ask nicely, there's always filtered water at the soda fountain. And so you can fill up and ice up rather than spending money every time.
Yeah.
And, actually, some states, there's a law that you have to allow people to access water at the fountain.
Yeah, good call. Are you going to be on your motorcycle this weekend when it's 90 plus in Seattle?
I am. There's a large group meeting of the PNW dual sport riders going down on Randall. So we're all going to be camping out and riding and... Yeah, it's going to be a hot one.
Yeah. Good luck in the heat. Thanks for the call. Good idea, Brian.
Sure thing. Yep.
Talking with Kendra Ramos. Take care. I'm talking Kendra Ramos is Director of Communication and Outreach at Washington Trails Association. What's some more advice or recommendations you can give us, Kendra?
Yeah, I think freezing water is a great idea. I tend to keep frozen water back in my car, too, for when I get back after my day of the trip. I also keep with me a bandana that I can cool off kind of on my neck or head. Having a hat and sun protection is super important. Similarly, sunglasses. I once had the unfortunate experience of actually burning the white of my eyes. And it's not one of those things you ever think about. So if you're going to be somewhere with snow can be really reflective. And so having that eye protectant is just as important as your hat and sunscreen when it's hot out, for sure.
Kendra, it's time to go. Do you know your astrological sign?
I'm a Virgo.
Virgo, V-I-R-G-O. So your WTA website says you're detail-oriented, analytical, eager to please. and et cetera, et cetera. And so as far as hiking recommendations for you, flex those organizational skills by making a creative itinerary. Try a through hike of Rainier's East Side Loop, or I think there's a few other ideas. You're reaching out. You're giving people some different ways to look at hiking, including hike by your sign at WTA.org. I just like that you're reaching people where we are and making outdoors fun, Kendra.
For sure. I mean, there's more than 4,000 hikes in Washington. The secret is to find the one that really inspires you. And so true to my sign, I'm spending my summer taking friends and family on little trips and helping all of them get outdoors a little bit, too. So it's a great way for me to see other parts of the state, too.
Kendra Ramos at Washington Trails Association, thanks for this time together.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it. It was fun.
It's always fun. It's the record on KUOW Seattle. We're coming to the end of our final week of shows before the record goes on a summer break. We're not just going to be hiking this summer. The record team will spend the summer reimagining a daily local news show, what it should be now. We want to know from you, what do you want out of a KUOW daily news show? Let us know by filling out our survey at KUOW.org/record. It's basically three questions. Has there been a moment when KUOW's reporting stood out and delighted you? Tell us about that. We ask about who you want to hear from, who should we talk to, and are you willing to have a little conversation with a member of our team to share more feedback? That's KUOW.org/record. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke, and I'll see you again tomorrow.